From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT Shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. This is the George Christensen Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the George Christensen Show. I'm George Christensen, and I'm joined in the next hour by one of my favourite politicians in Australia. He is a member of the New South Wales Legislative Council. He previously served as leader of the Australian Labor Party and leader of the opposition from December 2003 to January 2005 before he resurfaced to New South Wales state politics and is leading the One Nation team down there in New South Wales. I'm talking about the one and only voice for common sense in that part of the world, Mr. Mark Latham. It's great to have you on the show, Mark.
Thanks very much, George. Good to be talking to you. We've got an interesting election coming up on Saturday here in New South Wales, the largest state in the Commonwealth, and I think it's going to tell us a lot about the state of today's Liberal Party in particular.
Yeah, I think it certainly will. It'll probably tell us a lot about the state of the mindset of the voters as well. So I'm hoping that there is going to be a surge in support for people like yourself and other minor parties that are pushing for common sense, pushing for an end to wokeism. But mate, you're right to sort of finger the Liberal Party there. I mean, currently there's talk about the Liberal Party, and we've got international listeners as well, Mark. You know, the Liberal Party is not liberal in the American sense. It is supposed to be the mainstream conservative and libertarian party, except it doesn't act like that most of the time these days. They're currently in the midst of doing, or they might have done, a preference deal with the left-wing socialist Greens political party. Tell us about this, mate. It's just diabolical.
Well, everything in today's New South Wales Liberal Party is about green energy, green preferences, green everything, with Matt Keane, the deputy leader and treasurer, driving all the policy directions. You know, the Republicans have the phenomenon of rhino, Republican in name only. Here in New South Wales, we've got Lino's Liberal in name only, which I suppose is the equivalent of Sino, conservative in name only. So when you get to the point where you're dancing with the devil, that you're engaging in a preference deal with the Greens in New South Wales, such that the Liberals will preference the Greens in the inner city seats of Balmain and Summerhill, trying to stop Labor wins in those seats. And in return, the Greens are preferencing the Liberals ahead of the National Party in the three-cornered contest in Port Macquarie, where Leslie Williams, one of these koala-obsessed former National Party people, she defected from the Nats to become a Liberal, and she's out there on the far left of politics like most of them in today's Liberal Party. But, you know, when you get to the point where you're preferencing the Greens in any electorate, you're basically saying you don't mind the Green policies of full drug legalisation, gender fluidity teaching in schools, close down coal and gas yesterday, blackouts, higher electricity prices, the whole energy madness. So I think it's a weird, weird day when the New South Wales Liberal Party, the home of John Howard and Nick Greiner, is in bed with the Greens.
Well, it certainly is. But Matt Keane, as you've rightly mentioned there, just has such enormous influence over the party. It's really become the Matt Keane Green Party there, regardless of Dominic Perrottet, who a lot of people thought in Australia as the new premier, the relatively new premier, was going to instill a bit of conservative common sense back into the New South Wales Liberals, but far from it. I mean, it seemed to have lurched even more in the leftward direction. Tell us about Matt Keane. He's the energy minister down there. Tell us the kind of stupid policies that he is pushing that really undermine energy security for New South Welshmen and women, and tell us about how it's damaging business in New South Wales as well, Mark.
Well, 2.5 years ago, Matt Keane, as energy minister, introduced into the New South Wales Parliament his so-called electricity roadmap. And it was a mad rush to go 100% renewables within 10 years. And, you know, this is like turning around the Queen Mary on a 5-cent piece. You can't rebuild the entire electricity grid within the space of a decade. And the big expense that the public and the consumers are now wearing is to recognise that whereas New South Wales used to have transmission wires servicing the coal-fired power stations, mainly on the coast, the coastal strip where most people live, we now have to service wind and solar farms literally at the back of Bourke, way out in the western districts of the state. And to hook them into the grid is incredibly expensive. You're spending tens of billions of dollars on transmission corridors through prime agricultural land, wrecking country landscape. So it's bad in that respect, but it's incredibly expensive. The head of Alinda Energy let the cat out of the bag last year when he said, look, for spending $1 billion to generate electricity under the old system, coal-fired power, under the new system of renewables and this rewiring of the electricity grid, we've got to spend $8 billion. So that's a markup of 800%. George, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, the climate change people played a trick on the electorate. They basically said, we're going to try and save the planet here. That's a delusion in its own right. But we're going to try and save the planet. It's not really going to cost anyone anything. You're rebuilding the entire New South Wales, indeed Australian, electricity grid. And the Alinda bloke said to do that is a markup of 800%. And that's why the electricity bills have gone through the roof. So when Keane in the parliament introduced this electricity roadmap, in the upper house, One Nation called 85 divisions and ran a debate that went through the night. We watched the sun come up. We had a short breakfast break and it concluded in the late afternoon. So we had a day and a half of sitting called 85 divisions and the coalition of Liberal, Labor, National and Green voted against our amendments 85 times. And I said, and I suppose I did repeat myself because it was a long debate, I said two things are going to happen here out of Matt Keane's electricity roadmap. The first is you will drive the coal-fired power stations out early. And Liddell's closing next month, and most importantly, Eraring is closing in 2 years' time early, and that's a quarter of the state's electricity generation. So unfortunately, that prediction of mine has come to pass. Keane said, oh, no, nothing's closing early. Totally wrong. And the second thing I said is that you won't have the backup power in place with the pumped hydro and the gas peaking plants for when the sun's not shining, the wind's not blowing, and the renewables don't work 24/7. You won't have them in place. And we now find out Malcolm Turnbull's $20 billion white elephant of Snowy 2.0 pumped hydro is way behind schedule. And will it get hooked into the grid through the controversial Hume link that goes up to Goulburn? And the gas peaking plant at Curry is being stuffed around by Chris Bowen, who wants to put hydrogen in that the plant can't cope with. So it's 18 months behind schedule as well. So that too has come to pass. These things, George, were entirely predictable. And all we had to say was that Australia once had the cheapest, most reliable power in the world. Why did we ever change? And if you were going to change, you couldn't rush and do it in a decade. You needed to do it gradually, methodically, carefully over 40 or 50 years. Otherwise, the lights go out.
Yeah, and they've tried to do it in a one or two election cycles. That's what it boils down to, chasing the green vote. But the consequences of this are going to be absolutely disastrous for all Australians, not just New South Welshmen, but it will be disastrous for your state, Mark. I mean, I'm assuming, I don't need to assume, power prices are through the roof and will continue to go through the roof. But there will also be the consequence of blackouts, won't there?
Yeah, AEMO, the Australian Energy Market Operator, has forecast blackouts, particularly after the closure of Eraring. I mean, you take a quarter of the electricity generation out of the grid in 2 years' time. Well, blackouts are inevitable if you haven't got the backup power in place, and that's the case. So the official manager of the grid said New South Wales is going to have blackouts. So that's devastating for manufacturing, resources, retail investment in our state. Who would invest in a state that can't guarantee the lights are staying on? So it's devastating not just in 2 years' time, and we may well have blackouts this winter, but it's devastating right now for the message it sends to anyone investing in our state that they can't keep the lights on. I put this to Dominic Perrottet, the Premier, at Budget Estimates last year. I said, you've got AEMO forecasting blackouts in just 2 years' time, you know, a short space of time when you're talking about providing electricity generation capacity. I said to Perrottet, what are you doing about it? He said, I'll need to take some advice on that. I mean, this is the number one issue facing the people of the state. You can't keep the lights on. It's an economic and social disaster. And the Premier said, I need to take some advice. I followed up on the notice paper with a question and the answer came back, in terms of taking advice, he referred me to a non-answer I got from Matt Keane 6 months earlier. So they've got no idea. And Chris Minns, is just as bad. Labor supported the disastrous Keane roadmap, and they are sleepwalking us into blackouts. That's the reality of it. And in that debate I mentioned, we called 85 divisions. Matt Keane was going around to all his MPs handing out fruit and water. I said, Matt, you should be handing out candles, because that's what the people of New South Wales will need under your policy. And the prices are going up. Part of that legislation was Keane levying a new electricity tax on the distributors that they're obliged to pass straight on to households and businesses. And we now know the cost of that, $138 million electricity tax. That's the equivalent of a 5% increase on a $1,000 electricity bill. So everywhere you look, the prices are going the wrong way, because we're paying for remaking the grid in a faulty fashion that should never have been tried in the first place. And our One Nation policy, George, is to immediately halt the transition to a so-called green energy economy, because it was never needed in the first place. New South Wales, with 0.4% of global carbon emissions, can't save the planet, can't have any real impact on global surface temperatures. So why bother?
Mm-hmm. So prices, power prices up, blackouts more frequent, jobs down because of the impact on manufacturing and investor lack of confidence that will result as those blackouts and the increased power prices. And yet the temperature of the planet is not going to be changed one iota by all of this. What's driving it then, Mark? Is it just blind ideology, or is there something else that's pushing this spurring on this push for deindustrialisation of New South Wales and Australia?
Well, it's green energy, green ideology. The Greens, who have kind of got a red socialist element to them, they're not the party of Bob Brown, where they're just worried about trees. They're very worried about the future of capitalism, and they want to destroy it. So they are using climate change as a Trojan horse for attacking capitalism. And if the lights go out and manufacturing declines and businesses go broke and people lose their jobs, well, you know, that satisfies part of the green agenda. But you mentioned earlier on Matt Keane was doing it for green votes. Well, I don't know how many of those he gets, but I'll tell you what he has been receiving is a lot of campaign donations from renewable energy rent seekers. I went to a conference shortly after the last New South Wales election 4 years ago, and Keane was the main speaker. And you know, I've been around a while. I get to sense the mood of the room. And they were all looking at me like I had two heads, because they knew I was from One Nation, a supporter of nuclear energy, coal, gas, all the competitors to renewable energy. So it was pretty frosty reception I received. And I quickly worked out this was a renewable rent seekers jamboree. They're everywhere. I mean, every deep sea feeder is looking for an easy buck. Has got their hand out for these massive government subsidies to the renewable energy industry as they drive coal out of the sector, and we've still got the New South Wales ban on nuclear energy. So Keane has adopted policies to minimise competition to the renewable rent seekers, and they've been paying huge amounts over to the Liberal Party, where it was revealed Keane is the, by far, by the length of the straight, the main Liberal Party fundraiser. So money talks, and unfortunately these people have received the benefits financially from very bad public policy, from preferment policy, and they're donating to Keane, and that money is driving a big part of the agenda. But can I just say, George, in terms of impact on world temperatures, my office got the Parliamentary Library working with some of the institutes in the UK to say, if you bundle together Keane's transformation of the electricity grid, $10 billion a year in green energy programs, all he's spending on electric vehicles, hydrogen, the whole box and dice of all these subsidies, what is the outcome? What is the impact on global surface temperatures? And the answer came back, 0.00055 degrees Celsius, wait for it, over a century. So Matt Keane's great-great-grandkids might unveil a plaque one day to say their great-great-grandfather achieved 0.00055 degrees Celsius reduction in temperatures over 100 years. So we're talking about, you know, 2120 in the future, over 100 years, and at a huge cost to the economy, economic viability, the taxpayer, electricity prices in New South Wales.
Households,
Households, businesses, for such a puny outcome. You've never seen a more disastrous, deliberate public policy change in all your life.
It's just so sad. It's so sad that a party that used to style itself on free enterprise, such as the Liberal Party did, has gone down that crony capitalist path, and it's all green tinged crony capitalism these days. And you're spot on, Mark. I saw it while I was a member of the LNP.
Yeah, people ask me, how's the Liberal Party here gone to the left? I said, well, you've got the impact of the crony capitalism you've just mentioned, the green ideology of renewables and the money that talks. But you've also had a pincer movement where they've got globalists on one side and then they've got the diversity and inclusion mob, corporate consultants, who join the Liberal Party now. And all of that is a tidal wave sending them off to the woke left where basically you can't recognise them. You know, Alan Jones is known in the Liberal Party all his adult life. He used to work for Malcolm Fraser. He's probably launched more Liberal Party local campaigns than Menzies and Howard combined. Alan Jones now says there is no New South Wales Liberal Party. It has been totally destroyed by the cancer of Matt Keane from within. So when you've got Alan Jones saying that, it's a pretty sad reflection on a once great political party that now is some poor, pathetic imitation of the New South Wales Greens to the point where they're doing a preference deal.
Very, very sad indeed. We're going to be back with more of Mark Latham spitting out the truth here. We're going to talk about education policy and some of the disturbing things that have been going on within New South Wales schools here on the George Christensen Show as part of TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Dirk Pullman.
This is really something that bothers me because we had this before. We had the explosion of the Yamal pipeline, which was done by transmitting malfunctioning computer chips and software to the Soviet Union in a very elaborate intelligence scheme, because the Soviet Union tried to get access to American and European, Western microelectronic technology, and they were flooded in an operation by the American side with malfunctioning systems, chips and software to create the biggest havoc possible. And then the end game was that the Russians would notice that they had been flooded with junk, but they wouldn't know where it would be. The trouble was to get these chips out of the equipment because they used it for military terms. And there is a long history of the United States being very, very harsh, up to murder attempts or murder with people who are dealing with the Soviet Union.
The Dirk Pullman Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Google and Facebook, they don't sell you anything. They sell you.
Facebook constantly manipulates their users. They do it by the things that they insert into the news feeds, and they do it by the types of posts they allow their users to see.
It's what Google and Facebook are doing on a regular basis, by suppressing stories, by steering us towards other stories rather than the stories we're actually seeking. That's the real manipulation that's going on.
I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts.
It will always favor one online music service over another and one candidate over another.
Google and Facebook has the power to undermine democracy without us knowing that democracy has been undermined.
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it.
Google crosses the creepy line every day.
Discover how society is manipulated by Google and Facebook. The creepy line at salemnow.com.
And now a news update. The president's doctor has confirmed that the president is suffering from gastric distress. Apparently, he can't stop Putin.
You're stupid.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the George Christensen Show. I'm George Christensen. We're joined by the voice of common sense in New South Wales politics, Mr. Mark Latham from One Nation. Mark, you're facing an election very, very soon. The entire New South Wales government is. It'll probably be removed, no doubt, because of their leftward trajectory. They stand for absolutely nothing, certainly not the core traditional liberal values. That's been long lost. And one of the things that will stick in the mind of many people that normally would have voted for the Liberal Party has been their support for gender confusion within the school system, which a lot of us find extremely troubling. I mean, I discussed this earlier in this program with another guest. I mean, like you, probably have absolutely nothing against grown adults wanting to do their own thing in life. If they want to live life out, a man wants to live life out as a woman, or a woman wants to live life out as a man, that's their business. But once it starts creeping into the remit of children, that's when I want to blow the whistle. And I think many, many parents across New South Wales and elsewhere will think the same thing. You have been a champion on this issue, but I want you to talk us through what the hell is going on in New South Wales schools regarding this issue right now.
Well, the left wing of politics has this strange agenda that everything we know about ourselves, about history, about things like gender has been socially constructed. So they've thrown the biology textbook out the window. In their world, there's no such thing as the male gender or sexual identity or the female. It's all interchangeable. There's really no difference between men and women, between male and female. That's their idea of social construction and everything being fluid. It's designed to try and convince people there's nothing good, stable, reliable, steady about our society. It's all up for grabs, and the left can drive a wedge down the middle, particularly with confused teenagers. So they've been pushing this gender fluidity for that reason. And of course, there are major obvious differences between men and women, and sociologists have noticed behavioral differences over generations, that women like working with other people by and large, men like working with things, with their hands, in a more practical way. So you have these differences that we all know about. There are observable truths about male and female. But in the school system, they've been pushing gender fluidity. Now, George, I've asked a lot of people, and I'm yet to hear a valid explanation as to why gender or sexuality has got anything to do with education. New South Wales has had the fastest falling school academic results this century in the world, not just in Australia, the world. So we haven't got the indulgence of prattling on about gender fluidity when we're not teaching kids literacy, numeracy, and the basics of education. We've got 17,000 students in New South Wales who start high school, year seven each year, who are semi-illiterate. They can't read or write to a decent standard. So why is any class engaging in these gender political arguments, indoctrination? And Perrottet, who, you know, is under the control of Matt Keane and the woke left-wing liberals, has done nothing about it. I was sent material by a very concerned grandparent to the Yamina Beach Public School on the central coast of New South Wales, where they were running a gender fluidity class for year two, seven-year-old kids.
Year two. That is absolutely disgraceful. I think most people would be staggered to hear that.
Well, completely age inappropriate. And what would a seven-year-old know about questions of gender? Kids who are, you know, trying to learn to read and write. And these gender and sexuality issues are certainly adolescent and adult topics. They're not for seven-year-olds. So anyway, I question the National Party. Remember the National Party had people like you, George, you know, solid common sense, no-nonsense people. There's an education.
They got a few, but not many.
In New South Wales, Sarah Mitchell is from the National Party. And I questioned her and asked her to condemn it and make sure it happens in no other school, certainly not for seven-year-olds. She came back and said, oh, no, this was a lesson outside of class time. And I produced a document showing it was conducted very much in class time at the expense of literacy and numeracy, teaching kids to read and write. So she was wrong on that front and had to backtrack. But most importantly, she did nothing to stop this happening. And the other concerning aspect of the Perrottet-Sarah Mitchell policy, George, is that the children are given rights. The child that's made a so-called gender transition or claims to have has rights inside the system. So if the seven-year-old who did a lesson at Yamina Beach, a boy comes to school the next day and says, oh, well, I heard that lesson yesterday, I'm now a girl, you're not allowed to tell my parents. The school is obliged to follow the instructions of the seven-year-old kid. So we're putting seven-year-olds in charge of schools at the expense of their parents. And I again confronted Perrottet at budget estimates about it. He had no answer. He's done nothing about it. It's an appalling, appalling practice. I think these practices are child abuse because they talk about mental illness and mental health in children. Well, you want to confuse a kid, a seven-year-old, tell a boy he can be a girl. Tell a girl that she's really a boy. So in terms of confusing kids, this is child abuse, and the denial of parents in knowing about it is just appalling. It's just appalling. And that, no and that, good that is keeping parents in the dark.
And that has happened, Mark. I mean, there literally have been parents in New South Wales schools and schools elsewhere around the nation who found out through other people that their child has transitioned at school and knew nothing about this. It just seems so wrong.
Why? Yeah, not just in the government sector. I know a non-government school in regional New South Wales where the mum found out about her year 11 boy becoming a girl at the school in the supermarket aisles, where another parent said, that was interesting news about, you know, the name of the child is now a girl. And she said, what are you talking about? And it ripped the family apart because there was a younger sibling there who was told under duress to stay quiet about it. So it kept the parents in the dark, as well as the school keeping them in the dark. The grandparents refused to pay the school fees any longer. So this madness is also in the non-government school sector. And to see these families destroyed, it just confirms what I mentioned earlier on, no good ever comes from keeping parents in the dark, for the obvious reason the parents are there 24/7, always there to pick up the pieces with love and care and compassion. Parents don't get 6 weeks holidays at the end of the year. They don't move off to some other school. They don't get the weekend off. Of course, the parents are the primary educators of children and must always be told. I've got a bill we had in this current term of Parliament, I'll reintroduce it, that parents should have a legal right that the school always is obliged to tell them important news and personal development about their children.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very sound policy. And I sort of speculate, how do we get to this point, Mark, where parents have lost so much rights within the school system? And all I can think is that the long march through the institutions, we've had the cultural Marxists certainly capture teachers' unions. You would know that probably more than most other people. They've captured it, and then they've obviously captured the teaching profession by and large. And then they've gone on from capturing the teaching profession and the unions to capturing the education bureaucracy. So idea of gender fluidity, it obviously is very much a cultural Marxist idea. But more to the point, the concept that parents should not have control in any way, shape or form over their child is also a cultural Marxist thing. And I could point to something that most people don't know about. Over in Scotland, under the government of the Scottish National Party and the leader who's just stepped down over there, they proposed a bill which would have set up a government-backed guardian of the child. Every child would have been given a guardian who the child could go to sort out disputes between themselves and their parents. So that's the ultimate in what the cultural Marxists want. And that's why they're doing it in these schools. But what I don't know, so I get all of that. What I don't understand is how on earth a party that's supposed to be from the centre right, as the Liberal and Nationals are in New South Wales or are supposed to be, has just let all that go through to the keeper. When you stand up and ask these questions, Mark, do they dodge the bullets or do they try and justify it? What's their approach?
Oh, they dodge the bullets. And say they'll have a look at it and then do nothing. And George, it comes from weakness. The main DNA element in the sequence for today's Liberal Party is weakness, is cowardice. Mm. These are not conservatives, they're cowards. I get them in the corridor of New South Wales Parliament House, some of the remnant of those who say they're conservatives, and they say, oh, Mark, you we're pushing you forward to lead the charge on this. And they say this behind whispered hands, and I think, well, what are you doing about it? You know, are you going to speak out? Are you going to cross the floor? Are you going to vote with me? No, they just push me forward to lead the charge. I call them the corridor cowards of Macquarie Street, because that's what they are. This is the main element now. If they're not woke inside the Liberal Party, they're cowards. And this is a huge problem. The remnant of those who think of themselves, delusion, think of themselves as conservatives, they're absolute cowards. So they do nothing. And, of course, the cultural Marxists want to destroy the nuclear family unit, one of the most successful institutions of Western civilization. And in New South Wales, George, we have a thing called the Children's Guardian. I think every parent is the true guardian of their children. But we have a bureaucrat who's the Children's Guardian who pushes transgender. We have the New South Wales Teachers Federation here that ran a training seminar. I wasn't supposed to see it, but I got hold of it, where it ends by saying, if you find out, so they're trying to train the teachers, their membership, if you find out anything about the gender or sexuality of the students, it's not safe to tell the parents because these kids will go home and get bashed. Now, what a dreadful, dreadful slur against the loving, caring parents of New South Wales, 99.9% of whom do the right thing.
And that's right.
Parents say, like some, you know, cow chewing its cud watching the traffic go by, has just watched all this stuff go by, hasn't reasserted parental rights. And the main problem you've got, quite truthfully, is that there's some good teachers out there, but the left-wing teachers now regard themselves as more important than the parents. They have got way, they're not doing a great job in terms of school results, but they've gone way above their station in terms of their role in the personal development of the child and the whole well-being agenda. You know, oh, as long as the kids are happy, we let them do whatever they want. Combined with gender fluidity, is a complete and utter disaster.
Well, it has been a complete and utter disaster, Mark. I'm glad that you're there, though, to push back against it. Mate, I can only sympathise with you about the corridor cowards. Obviously, I don't have any experience in New South Wales Parliament, but in federal Parliament, I got sick of being the guy who'd get up during the party room meetings and call out some nonsense to only be met with stony silence, death stares from particular ministers and other people sitting up at the front table, then would get someone leaking to the media about what I'd said and get the woke media criticising me about something, only to have people that afternoon texting me or stopping me and saying, oh, well done for what you said there.
Yeah, that's it.
And you just think to yourself, why don't you speak up? Why don't you? But they won't.
Did any of them stand up and say, I support George? Did any of them cross the floor and yell out, I support George? No. You've got the same syndrome. What's happened to the National Party? Used to be strong, tough farmer types. What's happened to the Liberal Party? Used to be strong, tough captains of industry and business people. Where did they all go?
Yeah, well, mate, they've gone and they've been replaced by the snivelling, weak cowards that you spoke about, who
soy
mostly
boys.
Come out of
replaced by soy boys and soy boys and soy girls. They've replaced them. It's appalling. You wouldn't believe some of these people. They couldn't knock the top off a custard. It's appalling how weak they are. You know. Anyway, I've got a new adage for the next term of Parliament. The next one who comes up whispering behind their hand, pushing me forward, I'm going to grab hold of him, drag him down the chamber and say, this bloke here told me to come down and say these things and he's here with me and I want you to know he's my chief advisor and speechwriter and this weak bastard here ought to be accountable for what he's telling me.
Yeah, well, that's one way of dealing with it. That's certainly one way of getting them out into the public with what they really believe. Mark, so we've talked about the Libs and the Nats and their problems. And as I said earlier, I assume that because of everything that they've done or they haven't done, they're going to be removed from office. And I think that that's what most people believe looking at the polls. But the Labor Party, as you've indicated, are no better. Are they worse?
Oh, well, they went left a long while ago. I left them, a decade ago or more. So, you know, their embrace of climate ahead of jobs, their embrace of identity politics, race, gender and sexuality instead of helping battlers on the basis of need, regardless of what they look like, all of that has driven me out of the Labor Party. Tanya Mihalik, the member for Bankstown, who's now on my One Nation ticket. So yes. It's not just the Liberals who've gone bad. There's Labor people who've rebelled as well. And the significance of One Nation, George, basically, is that if you're after the mainstream, traditional Australian common sense approach to issues and you don't like the way Labor's gone radical left and the Liberal Party has followed them and left a huge vacuum, well, support us. We're there as the strongest group on the crossbench aiming at a disruption of the two-party system. You see, as long as the two groups, Labor and the Coalition, think they've got it to themselves, it's a two-horse race, they've only got to be a bit marginally faster than the other slow horse. So you've got to disrupt them, shake it up, and give them new viable competition. And One Nation in the polling is getting 15% across Western Sydney in lower house seats where we're running 10 different candidates. So that's very encouraging. That's a doubling and tripling of our vote from 4 years ago. Normally, there's also a bit of a hidden One Nation voter. Our people don't like to talk to pollsters as a rule. I don't blame them.
That's right.
And so, you know, we're going quite well and we're a chance to disrupt. If you want to shake up the two-party system, well, don't fiddle around with some micro party. Get with the strength of One Nation because we're starting to challenge these characters in heartland areas. And I think it's a very, very important moment in Australian politics to show that a minor party can emerge to be something a bit more significant than minor.
Yeah, well, here's hoping. And I know that you won't, this was a private chat that we had, you won't mind me saying it. I said to you a couple of months ago now, I think when I saw you at Coffs Harbour, that I think it's just astounding that we had the leader of the centre-left party in this nation who had gone over to basically be the leader now of what the fake news legacy media likes to describe as an extreme right party, that being One Nation, and I think they're wrong with that adjective, but nonetheless, that's what they ascribe. And you relayed to me that many moons ago, the average sort of branch meeting of one of the Labor branches, you could have had a tape recorder going and played it back today, and what was expressed in that room would have been the views of the average One Nation voter and One Nation politician these days. Is that right?
Yeah, spot on. When I joined the Green Valley branch of the Labor Party in Western Sydney in 1979, if you had a tape recording of the debate, it's One Nation today. So in many respects, I haven't gone anywhere. I've gone home. And that's a good feel in all parts of life, particularly politics. And, you know, I always say to people, you know, I lived through the politics of the 1990s. I was elected to the House of Representatives in 1994. So, and I say to my children, I feel privileged that I lived in Australia in the golden decade of the 1990s, went pretty well through the work of Hawke and then Howard and Costello. We worked out the policy settings that were best for Australia. They weren't perfect, but by and large, we'd worked out the pressing economic and social policy issues. And that approach, what would now be seen as a traditional policy approach, was a golden age for Australia compared to what we've got now, the whole Turnbull, Morrison, Albanese type of, you know, low-level leadership. So why did we ever change? Why did we ever move away from those settings in the 90s? Why did we replace job creation and prosperity with climate? Why did we replace socioeconomic need with identity politics, race, gender and sexuality? And I mentioned Tanya Mihalik earlier on. Read the letters of Jenny George written to the Australian newspaper, horrified by Labor deserting working people in the name of climate God complex. Jenny George, former head of the Australian Trade Union Movement, former Labor federal MP. So, you know, we had a policy setting in the 90s that worked well for this country. Why did we ever change? And One Nation is not a far right-wing party. We're a party in New South Wales deeply rooted in the policy settings of the golden age of the 1990s. We're best described as policy traditionalists, the things that actually worked for this country. And the way that they were taken away and things don't work any longer is a bad reflection on those who made the change. So, you know, we're in the centre of policy traditions in this country and very, very proud of it.
Very good. And I'm speaking with the one and only Mark Latham. We'll be back shortly after this break to talk about something that's not talked about that often, and that's debt and deficit. Also talk about what One Nation is going to do should it get the balance of power here on the George Christensen Show on TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Gallup is out with brand new poll results on Americans' attitudes towards the Middle East, and some of the numbers are not good at all. Remember back in October of last year when former President Trump warned American Jews they had better get their act together and realize what they have in Israel before it's too late, noting that evangelical support for the Jewish state outpaced that of Jews in America. For that legitimate concern, Trump was labeled an anti-Semite by the ADL, the White House, and media. Of course he was. The aforementioned groups are made up mostly of Democrats, and Gallup has found that Democrats sympathize more with the Palestinians than the Israelis, 49% to 38%. That's an 11-point increase in Democrat support for the Palestinians in the past year. And to Trump's point, It's worth noting that some 70% of Jews in America lean Democrat. Independents are more sympathetic to Israel, 49% to 32%, but that's up 6 points for the Palestinians. Republicans, they're 80% to 11% in favor of Israel. Overall, the Palestinians register a new high of 31% support, while the 54% of Americans sympathizing more with the Israelis, that's the lowest since 2005. And you can thank the Dems and the biased anti-Israel media for those numbers. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Unlike other health concerns, mental illness is not always easy to see. Depression won't show up on an eye chart, and you won't find PTSD by looking at a thermometer. Sorting out a mental health concern takes professional diagnosis and treatment. Anxiety won't just go away under a bandage. If you or a loved one has a mental health concern, call 1-800-662-HELP for free and confidential information and treatment referral. Learn more at samhsa.gov/support.
If you're talking about it,
playing games with the debt ceiling is dangerous and would spell disaster.
We're talking about today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the George Christensen Show. I'm George Christensen. We're joined in the final 15 minutes of the program by the one and only Mark Latham, the voice for common sense in New South Wales politics. Mark, debt and deficit, it seems to be things that not only have the major political parties, particularly the Liberal Party that used to campaign on this front, just completely ignored. It actually seems something, saddeningly, that most voters simply ignore as well. I got to say, I'm not one that can instantly recall how much debt that New South Wales has got itself into, apart from it's probably a lot. Tell us what has happened with the debt in New South Wales and what's likely to happen if the current trajectory isn't changed.
Well, a lot is over $180 billion of gross debt, over $120 billion of net debt. So that is a lot, George, and it's driven by budget deficits of the order of $12 billion and the massive spending spree that the government's engaged on. You know, one of the strange tactics of Perrottet is to surround himself with children during this election campaign. It's true as a family man.
I've noticed that.
Himself. But for every man, woman, and child in New South Wales, that net debt is $17,000. So for every child you see in the election campaign, $17,000 of debt liability hanging around their neck, and it's not you or me that's going to pay it off. It's their generation and their kids. So it's a huge financial burden going forward. And every single dollar that Minns and Perrottet are promising in this election campaign is borrowed money. Perrottet's got a policy of giving $400 for a future fund like superannuation for children. But I'm sure he sat the kids down and said, listen, you've got a choice here. We can pay down the debt and you clear your $17,000 liability for the future. Or we'll give you $400 a year. They'd say, we'll get rid of the $17,000. There's not much of a bargain to give them $400, and that's borrowed as well, adding to the debt problem. So that's a hoax and a half. And the reality is that out of the COVID period, the Liberal Party just has three policies now: spend, spend, and spend, and all of it's borrowed money. We have an interest bill on our debt in New South Wales that's greater than the money that's spent on the police force, that's greater than the money spent on TAFE. That's how big the interest bill is, and of course that adds to your deficit budgetary problem. So these are critical issues. And just as I mentioned the 1990s, Howard and Costello were there to pay down Labor debt and clear the deficit. You know, get the budget into surplus, pay down the debt. And they did that. That's now a foreign concept. The way Morrison and Frydenberg spent in Canberra and the way Perrottet and Keane have spent in Macquarie Street, paying down debt and fiscal prudence is no longer part of the Liberal Party makeup. Mike Baird, back in the day in New South Wales, legislated a Fiscal Responsibility Act. That sounds great. It had all these parameters for fiscal responsibility, and they just didn't talk about them. They made them law, LAW law. And the Liberal
What's
Party...
What's happened to that?
Well, they breached their own Fiscal Responsibility Act. They've broken the law their last three budget, and they're probably going to break again the next three budgets if they're re-elected. So when you get George, I tell you what, in politics, you're going bad when you break your own laws. Laws designed to instruct you on how to be fiscally responsible. You break them with overspending three budgets in a row. I'll give you another statistic. I did an analysis of the last two budgets, the first by Perrottet when he was treasurer under Gladys Berejiklian, and the last one by Keane under Perrottet as premier. The government made across those two budgets a combination of 362 voluntary policy changes. So these were discretionary policy changes where they said, we're changing policy, it has an impact on the budget. Right. 359 of the changes were spending increases. Just three of them were cost savings. Three out of 362. So what's that? Less than 1% of every policy change under Perrottet and Keene is a cost saving. So you can just see there the dimension of fiscal extravagance, and of course made worse in an election campaign where they're spending like drunken sailors.
Yeah, and this the policy that you referred to earlier, the $400 a year for every child, it's one of those policies that just seems to me to be completely ill thought through. It's one of those Hail Mary passes that are thrown when a party knows it's unlikely to win an election, in the hope that you know, they might save the furniture. So I don't think it'll see the light of day. But if it did, it is only going to result in more and more debt, and those same children, as you point out, having to pay it back somehow. And this is the one thing that I find difficult, Mark, is that people just simply don't equate government debt with their debt. You know, but that's the reality. The government doesn't play with their money. They play with your money, with our money. And at some point, the whistle blows and you need to pay up through registration fees, taxes, levies, tolls, whatever you like to call it. It's coming out of your pocket at the end of the day. How do we get more and more people to understand this, Mark?
Well, there will be a reckoning. And I suppose the most immediate point to say, if there's another virus or there's another financial meltdown internationally, how do we fund a future stimulus package when we're already up to our eyeballs in debt? So that's an obvious limitation that needs to be corrected. But if you've got governments that are out of the habit of any cost saving, they basically say in New South Wales there's a $95 billion budget there, a public sector that's full of waste and mismanagement, but they can't find any savings. So once they give up on that, the only way the reckoning is ever achieved is increasing your taxes. And you're starting to see this under Albanese and Canberra. So that's when you find out it does affect you. The cost of living crisis is made worse, not just by the fact that the budget deficits are driving inflation and interest rate rises, but in the end, you'll have to pay higher taxes to clear the debt. And it can't go on forever, and the Liberal Party have lost their way. And one of the remarkable things, George, on the 1st of February, I put out a list of all the cost savings One Nation would advocate, and prime among them is the fact there are so many state government expenditures now that duplicate what's already happening in Canberra. Why are we spending tens of billions of dollars a year on green energy and renewable and transmission programs when it's a national responsibility? If you believe in the climate change thing, it's an international thing. Well, obviously, the Australian government has to deal with it, not New South Wales under Matt Keane's delusions of grandeur. So that's a duplication of effort. We've got trade commissioners. We've got spending on GP clinics, otherwise covered by Medicare, out of Canberra. We've got New South Wales government spending on university R&D, which is a federal responsibility. So there are so many areas where the state government is wasting money by spending on the things that Canberra should be doing. And as soon as Canberra says, oh, well, New South Wales is spending in all these areas, we'll cut back our effort. So it's a cost saving for Canberra at the expense of the New South Wales taxpayer. So there's so many areas where we could tighten the budget. I suppose arts spending is another one, consultancies, advertising, public sector, fat cat salaries. I mean, there's a whole list. I could barely fit them on a page. So there's a lot of savings that can be made, but we're the only ones talking about it.
Yeah. Well, mate, if you had to tell me what your top 3 to 5 plans were, policies were, that you're taking to the election, what are they?
Well, keep the lights on. That's the immediate challenge, because that's crucial to our economic and social future. When the lights go out, the hospitals are on generators, the schools aren't working, the traffic lights are gone, your house is blackened, you're fumbling around for the candles, and you're probably going to lose your job. So, you know, the disaster of that, we've probably been spoiled in Australia when we had the cheapest and most reliable power in the world. So when the blackouts come, that's a huge issue. The second one is related to it, to bring down the electricity and gas prices. New South Wales is only 5% gas self-sufficient. The Baird government effectively ban gas in New South Wales. Well, you can't bring the prices down if you've got no supply. And poor old Santos up there in Narrabri, been a five-year delay just to get their gas operation up and running. So it's disgraceful, the bias against fossil fuel exploration and development. So you've got to let rip with coal, gas, nuclear, renewables. You know, the more supply of power we have, the lower the price, as well as getting rid of things like Keane's $138 million electricity tax. So that's the second big one. The third one is turning around these failing school academic results. So all the school reforms are absolutely necessary. If you follow the evidence in what works in the classroom, you'll actually achieve good results. And that's our policy with bringing back the school inspectors to achieve that in each and every classroom. The fourth one would be that issue of the school content. Get rid of rubbish like dangerous, damaging rubbish like gender fluidity. Get rid of the nonsense they're teaching in English. PDHPE used to be physical education. It's now sort of left-wing personal development and political indoctrination. I get so many parents ringing me up to say, oh, my 13-year-old daughter just came home and I found out year seven English is gender studies. So the curriculum is a big area for improvement and banning gender fluidity teaching in our schools. And the final area is on the freedom front, to never repeat the mistakes of the COVID period, but also to legislate religious freedom laws to stop the persecution, the rising persecution of Christians in particular, along with the other faith-based groups who've copped it in the past. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of problems, George. And if a sixth one is the one we discussed just moments ago about balancing the budget, which is critical.
Yeah. Well done on that suite of top policies there. Now, obviously, while we would hope that there would be a sweeping revolution and we'd have our first One Nation government, my common sense part of me tells me that's unlikely to happen. What we can hope for is for One Nation to hold the balance of power, at least in the upper house, and I think that's probably going to be a reality. But to actually have influence in that upper house, there really would need to be a change of heart from the Liberal and National parties to oppose some of this nonsense that they've overseen while in government. I find that sometimes these major parties do have the come to Jesus moments when they lose office. Do you think that this is possible, Mark?
Well, I'm not optimistic because of the dominance of Matt Keane and the Green agenda and the cowardice of those corridor cowards that we discussed earlier on. So they'd have to grow a spine in quick order to make any impact. So I'm not optimistic. But, you know, whoever they are in the upper house, it's a chamber with 41 votes in New South Wales. If there's a Labor-Green coalition minority government in the lower house, you'll need people like One Nation there to knock the rough edges off their extreme agenda, the drug legalisation, the gender fluidity teaching, the banning of coal and gas, keeping the lights on, the whole agenda I've described. So we need as many One Nation people in the upper house as possible. We've got two at the moment. We want to grow that to five if we can. Mm-hmm. And supporting our group gives you, you know, the biggest oomph for your vote, because you can get with the strength and obviously we're a no-surrender party. We never wave the white flag on any of these issues. Mm. So you get pretty good value from a party of fighters. So I hope that's the outcome. And if the Liberal Party join us in that task in opposition, good. If they don't, we'll be fighting twice as hard.
And so along with pushing these policies or at least changes to some of the damaging policies, you will be continuing your role and no doubt the other members of the team will continue in your footsteps, basically being a bit of a guard dog and exposing some of these crazy things that are going on that voters otherwise wouldn't know about. Would that be right, Mark?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of our work is exposing the horror of what's going on and putting pressure on. When parents tell me about these wretched things happening in their child's classroom and I stick it in the media or raise it in Parliament, you know, I ring them up 6 months later and they say, well, that bad publicity the school got, they put them on notice. Someone is watching them. Someone is watching them. They can't get away with this political indoctrination all the time. And they pull back. You know, we play a very useful role in exposing what's going on so they don't do it again. They know they're being watched. So it's a big job, a huge job across the vast New South Wales public sector. But I think we do it pretty well.
Well, I think you do it pretty well, Mark. We've almost run out of time here on the George Christensen Show, but before we go, could you tell listeners where they can find out more about Mark Latham and your team, where they can sign up to support your agenda?
Well, there's the One Nation website, of course, but also my Mark Latham's Outsiders Facebook page. And if you're voting a pre-poll during the week or next Saturday at the regular polling booths in the upper house, we're Group Q. So if you vote one above the line in Group Q, you've cast your vote for One Nation in just one square. So that's the name of the game.
There you go. Thank you very much, Mark Latham. All the best with the election this weekend. And you've been listening to The George Christensen Show here on TNT Radio.